Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Each month brings new revelations and complications to the United Kingdom's decision in 2016 to Brexit, or leave the European community. Many of these issues were seemingly unmentioned prior to the referendum in question. My guest today, like his longtime constituents in Scotland, is firmly opposed to Brexit, and he joins us today to speak about the possible consequences of the action on things like Northern Irish peace or the stability of the United Kingdom. Henry McLeish is a former First Minister of Scotland and a former Scottish footballer turned Member of Parliament. He represented the constituency of East Fife for 12 years in the British Parliament, the last two as a member of Tony Blair's cabinet, where he took a leading role on devolution, the return of some authority to Scotland and a revival of the Scottish Parliament. He then was elected to the Scottish Parliament in 1999, and just a year later served as First Minister, the leader of the Scottish Parliament. He retired from public service in 2003. Since then, he's been a visiting professor at universities across the United States, including his current post teaching European studies at the St. Mary's University Law School in San Antonio. And he's authored several books on Scottish politics. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, and I spoke with him while he was here. Henry McLeish, welcome back to Tulsa, and welcome to Studio Tulsa.
Absolutely delighted to be here.
I'd like to start with the impact of Brexit. You've recently said Scotland should be allowed to stay in the EU. Is that right? We know that Scotland voted overwhelmingly against Brexit in the June 2016 referendum, but how would that work?
Well, Brexit, by its very definition, is extremely complicated. It's been a very confused situation, but most people have to, I think, accept that if Brexit goes ahead, which I hope it doesn't, then there will be consequences. And it seems to me that Northern Ireland and Scotland voted to remain in the EU, and Wales and England decided to leave. Now, constitutionally, we're part of the United Kingdom, so we can't do that breakaway. But I think what might happen here is if we have what they call this hard Brexit, coming out of the single market, coming out of the customs union, coming out of the EU, a lot of Scots will feel that when they voted in 2014 in a referendum to stay in the UK, it was like, buy one, get one free. Stay in the UK, you were part of the EU. Now, the whole discourse changes if we're faced with a situation that against the wishes of Scots, we're forced out of the EU. In my view, it may reignite the whole issue of Scotland separating from the United Kingdom. And it would be a consequence that of Brexit. It's a consequence that everybody can see ahead. But stubbornly, the British government is willing to take this kind of, to me, ideological, kind of delusional position. They've put the red flags out. They won't change them. And we could be heading for a hard Brexit. And not only in Scotland will there be consequences, there would be tragedy if the very peaceful existence of Ireland and Northern Ireland was affected in any way.
What are the latest opinion polls show about the popularity of Brexit in the United Kingdom as a whole? Is it still slightly more popular than unpopular, or has the consequences been rolled out enough where people are saying, maybe we should rethink this?
Well, when you consider, it's a great question. When you consider that, in my view, the referendum was not a debate on the European Union, it was a debate on the future and the state of the United Kingdom. And you have a situation there where 17.4 million people voted to leave, 16.1 million voted. So it was 52-48, quite close. What has happened since then? A lot of people have reflected on this, and the percentage, the polls show that percentage-wise, there's been a slight shift to remaining. So some people are beginning to regrexit, as we now call it, without getting complicated. So that's one shift. But the second shift is that is now beginning to dawn on British people. This is such an enormous break with reality as well as the European Union, and the consequences could be dire. So therefore, a lot of people are beginning to think, do we need a second referendum? Do we need Parliament, where there is a natural majority to stay in, to vote down Brexit? So there's momentum building up. And for example, the Labour Party, the principal opposition party, it's now changed its position and it's now said it wants to stay in the customs union. So ostensibly, if we stay in the customs union, we're halfway towards staying in the European Union. So things are changing. Polls have shown some change in percentage terms, but there is a feeling now that this is such an, excuse my description of it, an act of such monumental stupidity
Yeah. Now, you've talked about three different aspects of the UK staying in the European Union. One would be staying in the European Union. I assume that's the European Parliament. That means all the regulatory issues as a part of being the EU, which a lot of those were unpopular and sort of was one of the fuels for Brexit.
Yeah. Well, if you take the fact that to be in Europe in any way, you've got to be under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. You've got to pay as a member of any club what's due to them for that. And of course, you're absolutely right to say that the Brexiteers, the, in my view, the kind of cheap patriots in the government were trying to say, well, why should the Germans make your laws? And why do we have to be part of this? And, you know, it really reflects in a way what's been said in America. Let's make Britain great again.
Right.
And a lot of the delusion is the fact that we used to oversee the world. We colonized. We had empire. And there's that part of the English vote which he said, yeah, we were much stronger. But of course, life has changed. And that's why I believe that they're not facing up to realities. But on the other hand, a lot of the people who voted for Brexit were the same people who voted for President Trump. Mm-hmm. Similar background, socioeconomic profile the same. And to be fair to a lot of them, the so-called progressive parties like the Labour Party in Britain and the Democrats were not offering people anything. And they decided this entitlement issue is up and we will vote for something or vote for someone. We know that he might not build a wall. We may not get this in Britain. But people are just yearning to be listened to. And I think part of the Brexit vote was people saying that.
When you looked at a lot of the industrial north, that was a big area where it was. And is it a matter of we want the mines open, we want the factories back open, or is it something different?
It's something similar, because if you take Pennsylvania, Ohio, look, you've got families there where, you know, maybe the people are in their 50s or the 60s, and they remember where they made things.
Yeah.
Coal mining was well paid. Steelworks were well paid. Now, no disrespect to kids working in coffee shops, but, you know, they had pensions, these people. They had futures, and they're now pensioners. And they're looking around and saying, well, what's my son or daughter going to be doing? Well, will they get jobs that will have a pension, will have a future? So as a consequence of that, instead of looking forward, which is pretty bleak for them, instead of being happy with the present, they often look over their shoulder to real or imaginary times. And a lot of people are saying to the elites and the Democrats and Labour Party, look, what about us? And it's not a selfishness, because the figures show conclusively since the crisis in 2007-08, banking, financial and economic, that the wages of the poorest groups have gone down dramatically. Mm-hmm. But the wages and salaries of middle classes and above have shot up. And quite rightly, people are saying to all of us so-called progressives, hey, I feel ignored. I feel neglected. And it's what about me? And they're not being selfish. They're just basically saying out of self-interest, we need a change. And that's why I think there's this volatility in politics just now everywhere in Europe and certainly in the United States.
So what do parties like Labour in the UK, the Democratic Party in the United States, and those parties which have thought to have been traditional champions of working people but haven't really been in the last couple of decades, do they need to refocus their efforts?
Yes, they do. You know, and I'm guilty. I mean, I was in politics for 30 years.
So you remember Labour government of Tony Blair's government.
Indeed, I'm not passing blame to others that I wouldn't accept myself. But I do think there's been a bit of complacency on the part of progressive parties. I think that, you know, we talked about the end of history after the war, that Soviet Union has collapsed, Berlin Wall has fallen, democracy is strong and robust, but it's not. And what has happened there is that we've become complacent. And when you consider the situation in the United States, a lot of people, I think, have voted for President Trump. They know that there's not going to be a wall built. They know this is not going to be done. But they had to protest in a big way. And to be critical of the other campaign was that some states were literally ignored as far as campaigning goes. So I think overall, progressives in Western Europe, Britain and America, we've been complacent. We've actually thought it was the end of history, that everything is just flowing democracy's way. And we're now in a position where if you take countries like Turkey, the Philippines, even Saudi Arabia with its strange setup.
Poland,
Hungary. You've got a situation there where people think authoritarianism, no, it can't happen. You know, this issue about race and colour, it won't get too bad. But look, it is getting bad. And politics for me is always a continuum. You know, there's extreme lefts and rights. And people think things are not moving, but you may just move an inch. It makes the next move easier. And all of a sudden, you're moving to authoritarianism, you're moving to isolationism, economic nationalism. And in a world where we're saying, well, we like hard men and we'll compete with this. The world's a small place. We're interdependent. We have to, in a way, love each other, because if we don't work together, we're going to have serious problems in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years that are unimaginable but can be dealt with now.
We'll take you back to Brexit a little bit. One of the things you said was, you know, when the independence referendum in Scotland occurred in 2014, it was like, well, you know, it was an easier vote to vote down independence because you're still part of the EU. So your fear, as I understand it, is that with Brexit, that's going to stoke more talk of independence. Yeah. Is independence a good idea or a bad idea for Scotland? Because when you think of the money that flows from south to north, mm-hmm. there's a lot of money that flows from south to north. Yeah. Would Scotland be stable as an independent country?
Well, as you know, a lot of independence, whether it be Catalonia and Spain, Scotland, it's all about identity,
right?
Cultural politics. And in that 2014, there was the issue that if you voted to stay in the UK, you got the EU. But the big issue that was raised at that time was the risk of Scotland leaving the UK. A lot of older people worried about pensions, whatever, the risk. What is interesting now is that if the UK leaves the EU, the risk could work the other way. And it might be a safer long-term bet for Scotland to be in Europe, not be in the UK, because all the calculations show there is an amazing financial consequence of leaving the EU. But you asked the question, Scotland, of course, could be independent. And a great model for Scotland would be to be like Scandinavia countries, Denmark, Sweden, very civilized, very welfare, significant taxes, high standard of living, and just a different feel. So Scotland could be a Scandinavian country, but Britain can't be, because it's 60 million more people who live there. So balancing up, I was one, for example, a personal opinion, I was one who voted to stay in the United Kingdom. It won't be as easy for me next time round to make this decision if, as some people want, we have Brexit, it was a hard Brexit, and we leave. And as a good European, I often describe myself as, first of all, being Scottish, as a patriot, secondly, European now, and thirdly, British. Now, I can't think I'm unique. So if you have that turnover in who you identify with, that's going to be a powerful factor.
Now, you were heading up the devolution process when the Scots were giving more authority. Mm-hmm. That has not worked out in practice as perhaps it was thought in theory. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have a Scottish Parliament, but still a lot of decisions are still made in London.
Oh, yeah.
And you've promoted a UK policy of creating more of a federalist authority. How would that work in regards to Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland?
Well, the basis for that was that there are two options just now. One is independence, which could be supportable. The other one is stay in the United Kingdom on the same terms. And whilst we have powers over many things, we get a massive check from the United Kingdom government, real power is still not part of us, illustrated by the fact that we have just been ignored, Scotland, in terms of the EU process. So my view is that to pitch an alternative, a lot of Scots are not yet decided they want to leave the UK and may never be. They are looking for an alternative, and it could be federalism. Now, you have a well-developed federalist state, so do the Germans, and federalism varies. Federalism of a kind I'd like to see where we do have a written constitution, which we don't have just now, so that Scotland would know its powers, Northern Ireland. Secondly, we'd have a situation where the politics were taken seriously. A lot of people in London just think we're an offshoot of Westminster, and that's extremely irritating to Scots. And the third thing is to then say that you're not on your own completely, because Treasury matters would be dealt with in London, but you have more power. Now, strategically, I think if we do that, it offers Scots a real choice. Forget the status quo. Do you want to be part of the UK on a different basis, or do you want to leave and be independent? It may well be that Scots might opt for independence. My view is they'll opt for federalism. But here's the problem. Federalism is not a natural part of a parliamentary democracy. We don't have a written constitution. We don't have any sense that out with London anything matters, because the absolute sovereignty of Westminster means we don't like Europe, they're meddling. We don't like too much power going to parts of Britain. And so if you ask me then the really exposing question, could it ever work? I have serious doubts. On the other hand, as a Democrat, I'd like to give Scots a choice. It may be a forlorn choice, and it may not happen, but it allows the UK to acknowledge that in the world we're changing, whether it be Belgium, whether it be Spain, whether it be Scotland, people want their identity recognised. It doesn't mean to say they're raging revolutionaries or extremists, but they like the idea of patriotism, not nationalism. They like the idea of being part of the UK, but as long as it's on the right terms. So that may be complicated for American listeners, but there are some really big issues there. And I'm one that doesn't believe in the world of extremes. You know, your Congress operates on the politics of extremes. If you're not with us, you're against us. It can't go on like that, and it's the same in Britain.
My guest today is the Right Honourable Henry McLeish, the former First Minister of Scotland. He's currently a visiting professor of European Studies at St. Mary's University Law School in San Antonio. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on turbulent times in Western democracies. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, we talked briefly, you mentioned the Ireland question, and this is where Brexit really could cause some really serious issues. You have a, seems that even today at times, a tenuous peace in Northern Ireland. And a big part of that peace is the idea that there are, you know, no borders between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Brexit means borders. And the EU has come up with a proposal which, well, we understand that Northern Ireland is a special case. We can create the border in the Irish Sea. The London government has said, never in a million years. And so you have this really potential powder keg. How serious is this situation in Ireland over Brexit?
It is serious, but it's been made much more serious by the bloody-mindedness of the Westminster government. Because the only solution to the Brexit dilemma is that the whole of the United Kingdom stays in the customs union. Now, the government of Theresa May has said, over my dead body. And so that has become the problem. She's identified what she wants to achieve. The European Union has told her, you can't have your cake and eat it. And if there's a hard Brexit coming out of both the single market and the customs union, there will have to be a border. Now, the real tragedy about that is that Conservative governments under John Major and eventually under Tony Blair worked hard to see a land in which killings and murders and abductions had gone on between Catholics and Protestants, DUP and Sinn Féin. And it was a fabulous moment in UK history when that was struck. Now, all of a sudden, there's two things. One, we may have a border back. And the only way we can resolve that is for Theresa May to change her mind, which she doesn't like to do. But the second big issue is it will start to raise again the spectre of a united Ireland. The history is complicated. Nothing about Ireland is easy. But in the 1920s, 26 counties became Ireland, and six counties, for political and religious reasons, stayed with the United Kingdom. Now, Sinn Féin, in the Northern Ireland Parliament, their assembly, they're the largest group now. Things have changed. And listen to Gerry Adams, listen to some people. If it's a bad Brexit, they could say, well, look, would you like to be in the European Union? Would you like to be part of the Ireland that you used to be part of? And a lot of people in Ireland might say yes. So these are tragic consequences that are foreseen, but the government currently has no argument and seems willing to risk that border being constructed.
So the Northern Ireland demographics have changed from...
Yes.
So Catholics are now a majority in a good part of Northern Ireland?
It would be unwise of me to confirm that, but certainly the demographics have changed. And what is complicating matters, which need not delay American listeners, is that the DUP, my version of the Tea Party in Northern Ireland, they are now propping up the Westminster government. Theresa May doesn't have a majority.
That's right. They're the coalition partner.
And at the same time as they're propping up the Westminster government, the two sides in Northern Ireland can't agree, and their own assembly has been closed down, was closed down for a year because of that. So, you know, politics can be messy. It's not a reasonable science, but you can avoid some things if you just take a sensible look at things and come up with sensible solutions. And I'm very angry that the work at Blair and Major and, you know, that Gerry Adams, a whole host of people, including the DUP, put into this fantastic solution is now in danger of crumbling.
How important is this customs union? And I assume the customs union is the ability to move goods, to buy goods in Europe and bring them back into the UK without duties, without...
Well, quite simply, I mean, I understand for, you know, I think sometimes myself, I need an Albert Einstein pocketbook to know what's going on. But the single market essentially is based on the single European Act 1986. It means that you have free movement of goods, services, people and investment. People can live, work, trade, do anything within the confines of the 28 countries. The customs union essentially means that there are really no borders. It means that within the EU, there are no tariffs. And the EU then is a one block. Has common tariffs for any external country bringing goods in. It works fantastically well. It's 506 million people. We're the largest importer in the world. We're the largest exporter in the world. And along with China and the US, we dominate investment trade. But once you come up the customs union, you then start to have problems with barriers. You start to have problems with customs. And then with the single market, it's not just the trade. It's the regulation. It's the standards. It's pharmaceutical standards. It's this standard. And why on earth a country would want to give up all of this on the basis that we want absolute sovereignty? Even America doesn't have absolute sovereignty now in a world like this. And we want to have all our laws made in Britain. There's nothing wrong with the European laws. Only 18% are made in Europe. And then finally, as a club member, of course you've got to pay a fee to be a member. But Britain has negotiated itself into a horrendous position where it is basically saying, we want to get all the benefits of being in the EU, but by the way, we're leaving and we expect to get them out of it. Now, whether you're right or left, centre, north, south, that's just an absolute nonsense. And sadly, that's where we are.
Certainly, the Brexit is still several years away. But as you well know, there are a lot of Britons that vacation, actually maybe even have residences within the EU, in Spain, mm-hmm. in southern France. Is all this in jeopardy if it really tears apart?
Well, I think to be fair, what they've tried to do, I mean, there's two parts to the negotiation. One is the divorce settlement, which is essentially, basically you've got to pay up and whatever. But there are agreements. They've got some edges to be sorted out that the Europeans in Britain will be safeguarded and Britons working in Europe, living in Europe, travelling in Europe will also be safeguarded. So that's a mutual interest thing. And that makes sense. It's a collection of nations. But it's just the fact that if something's, it's the classic phrase, if it's working, don't try and mend it. And this is one of the problems. But for me, I have a very internationalist perspective. I mean, I think, you know, we live in one planet, but sometimes we act as if we'd lived in different ones. And it's this idea that the European Union has shown as one of the best creations in post-war world that we can live together. And what people tend to forget, and British people tend to forget, is that the EU was set up to prevent wars and to try to offer people stability and security over the period and prosperity. Now, it's largely done that. And for example, for me, if the EU folded tomorrow, it would have achieved its greatest goal that within the boundaries of the 6 countries originally, 28 countries now, no wars. And if you think about the state of Europe in 45 and without the Americans, the Marshall Plan, NATO, Bretton Woods, they helped us reconstruct a continent. And all of a sudden, Britain, out of all the 28, seems to have this special type of amnesia. It doesn't want to remember any of that. And for the pride of being British, we want to walk away. I'm sorry. It's sad, but it's also crazy.
You mentioned right now that public opinion is maybe shifted slightly. So it's instead of being 48-52, it's 52-48 against Brexit. It's a 50-50
yeah.
question, really. Once some of these provisions come in, do you think that public opinion is likely to change?
Well, you talked about far ahead. Well, I mean, I think it's my calculation that a year come next week, we're out.
Wow. Uh-huh.
2019, March. Time is just running away, and they're no closer to an agreement now than they were when the result of the referendum was announced. So that's the first point. But I think the second point is, and I've been honest with you in this interview, I'm not any passionate, neutral observer to all of this.
Right.
And my fear is that we will spend the next 20 years not extolling the virtues of being free in some people's minds. The next 20 years, we'll just be trying to pick up the pieces of a mad decision. Now, if somebody could convince me, what are the benefits? And I've said to people that want to desperately to leave, I said, give me a benefit. For them, the only benefit is to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I say,
this idea of sovereignty,
correct.
True sovereignty.
Please tell me what this is about. You think leaving is a benefit. Now, if we leave and become the poorest economy, hypothetically, the poorest economy in Europe, is that a price worth paying to leave?
You'd have to go low. I have to admit, you have to go a long way to be the poorest economy in Europe.
I paraphrase what I said by basically saying, to be extreme. But you could look at other options and other possibilities. And it's just this idea. I mean, and I'm not any dewy-eyed internationalist romantic, but I do passionately believe in internationalism. And the point you made earlier, this is a troubled world. I wouldn't like to leave next year and then coming to your president, the Turkish president, the president of the Philippines, who's completely crazy, Netanyahu, who's a tough guy, Putin, who's a tough guy, President Xi, who's a tough guy and a... This is a difficult world, and all of a sudden we want to just, to use an English metaphor, pull the stumps up, leave the cricket ground, and move into a jungle. Sorry, that doesn't make sense to me either. And this is the kind of debate we should have had, because, as I said earlier, it was about peace. We've achieved that. It is about internationalism. There's great exchanges on education, great projects. And, of course, the EU can be reformed. I mean, it is a Christian club. Turkey's on the horizon. It's going to be a long time away, but they might join. So there are great opportunities. And the tragedy from 1945 has been, well, since the inception in 1952, European Coal and Steel, Britain has been there, but not really completely there. And we've been ambivalent. Now, I believe if Britain had taken a leading role from the start, you wouldn't have a Europe reflecting the interests of Germany, France, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, and Italy. You would have something that reflected the fact that we are not continental Europe. We have got a different history, with different pride, and we could have shaped Europe. But because of sitting on the sidelines, all parties have done it. Then we've pretended that if there are good things in Europe, we'll take the credit for them in Britain. But if there are bad things, we'll just blame the EU. And it's that kind of politics.
Well, I'm going to shift subjects greatly to a real tough question. It's been 20 years since Scotland has made a major international football tournament. The World Cup of 1998, you're a former footballer, and I noticed in the news you're being touted as perhaps the next head of the Scottish FA in some quarters. What's it going to take to get Scotland back into the World Cup?
Well, I knew you would get around sometime to the saddest point in my life. I always said last year with Brexit and Mr. Trump being elected, I had kind of two bereavements, but this is a long-term bereavement. You know, I was in Paris 20 years ago when I met Sean Connery on that special day. We were beating Brazil, and then we got beat 2-1. That was the last time we ever performed. You ask a question, it would take me about at least 100 visits back to your studio. But to be honest with you, I am such a passionate... I played soccer as a kid. I played professional football. I did a big review of Scottish football in 2010. Yes. And to be flattering to me, some people have touted that. That is not going to happen. But what I can say exclusively to your radio station today, I am about to put pen to paper to deliver a book on the future of Scottish football to be published hopefully in the August of this year and to appear at the Edinburgh Book Festival. And put simply, because a lot of people are not interested in soccer, but I would describe it as my real daydream, that, you know, a nation prospers in sport if they have a big enough ambition. They prosper in sport if they have enough elite young talent coming through to make sure they can play. Thirdly, they need a country that's devoted to a single objective of playing on the world stage. And fourthly, it doesn't need to be a genius to work out that Iceland, with 350,000 people against Scotland's 5.6, can qualify for the European Championships.
And beat England.
And the World Cup. And beat England. And here, the second home of football in the world is languishing to qualify. So on the 14th of June this year, it'll be 20 years. So I want to mark that by saying it doesn't have to be like that. We've just got to try harder. So next time I'm in Tulsa, we might start to qualify, but at the end of the day, it's like politics. Politics is for people who are optimistic. That's where the vision and leadership comes from. And if you take it upon yourself to say, I'm sorry to quote Barack Obama, but in Scotland, yes, we can. But we've got to convince ourselves that we can, and then we'll take on the world.
Well, Henry McLeish, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Henry McLeish is a former First Minister of Scotland, the leader of the Scottish Parliament, and a former member of the British Parliament. He's currently a visiting professor of European Studies at St. Mary's University Law School in San Antonio. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, speaking on the turbulent times for Western democracies. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.